You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares. Good morning, welcome to the show. Monday the 18th of March, just a shaft of sunlight through the window here in TW11 this morning. There is a hint of spring in the air, whisper it quietly, but an unsettled forecast for this week. And as we mix weather forecasts, we also mix codes, because no sooner is the Cheltenham Festival done and dusted and already much dissected, the flat season proper is nearly upon us in Britain and is upon us in Ireland. This bank holiday in Ireland today, day after St. Patrick's Day, first fixture of the year at the Curragh featuring the Irish Lincolnshire, and also featuring the first runner of the season for trainer Paddy Toomey, Group 1 winning trainer. And the reason I speak to him later in this podcast is that he tells me that he has secured the services of Shamie Heffernan to be a key part of his team this season alongside Billy Lee. Paddy has not let the grass grow under his feet. No sooner had Shamie Heffernan announced his decision to leave Ballydoyle by mutual consent, having been a stalwart of the world's most powerful training and racing operation for several decades, than Paddy struck and said, right, on you come and see what you can do to my outfit. And I suspect the answer is quite a lot. We'll find out a bit more later in the show. I'll also be talking to Alice Stevens, Rising Star jockey, as part of our Overbury People series. Very much looking forward to seeing the way her career develops and has been supported by Overbury right from the outset. But first, we must debrief the Cheltenham Festival. So many great moments. So many people will have left Prestbury Park quite happy, not only if they were participants like Willie Mullins or Dan Skelton or Kim Bailey or Fiona Needham, but many of you who've been to Cheltenham will have created memories that will last a lifetime. Having said that, Cheltenham this year, perhaps more than any other, received quite a lot of criticism, whether it was down to car park problems caused extensively by the weather, whether it was customer service issues, whether it was ticket prices, whether it was where you could and couldn't go during the course of the week, whether it was the calibre of the racing, the competitiveness of the racing, whether changes need to be made. Certainly, Julie Harrington from the BHA seemed alive to that last point when she penned quite a lengthy note of her own the night after the Cheltenham Festival, addressing the Irish dominance and recognising the need for British racing to do something to stem that or to negate that so that the festival may become more competitive. David Yates is alongside me today, newsboy from the Daily Mirror. Perhaps I should start, David, by recognising that there's been a lot of criticism from a lot of different quarters and asking you whether you think some or all of it is fair.
An awful lot of it is fair, not all of it, Nick. Obviously, they had the debacle of the car park on Tuesday, which it's the nature of things these days, isn't it? That because of social media, that got exposed. There was massive exposure. There was even an editorial piece about it on ITV Racing, quite a long one, actually. With regard to that, Cheltenham said they'd spent a lot of money on the tracking for the car park. They evidently didn't spend enough that day. Ian Renton told you yesterday that that they couldn't concrete over that Greenbelt site, which may be true. I think they got rid of a lawn in front of the grandstand with concrete, didn't they? So there might be areas of that in fact they could put concrete down. We'll discuss a few of the problems, and inevitably it's a bit like the milk in your tea. This, we can't separate the different strands and say, oh, look, that's to blame. The truth is that we don't know whether it was the lack of competitiveness on the track, the cost of living crisis, the way that Cheltenham treat their race goers. They're all ingredients that go into the cake, and it's very hard for us to separate them out again. I would say that I from a personal perspective, there's one thing that Cheltenham can do which will cost very little money, and that is make their customers feel much more welcome. I don't know of a big race course that is quite so unwelcoming to visit. Cheltenham do something pretty badly that other tracks can do quite well. I'd use Ascot as an example. Anyone of roughly my age will remember the time when Ascot was a pretty austere, unwelcoming place to go. The bowler hats seemed to make it their business to be rude to you. I think then when Douglas Erskine Crum came in, one of the things that he changed pretty quickly was to tell the bowler hats, you've got to help people, you've got to be welcoming. When you leave Ascot Racecourse, particularly during the Royal Meeting, there are loads of agency staff who have no particular interest in the future of Ascot Racecourse. I'm sure they're on salaries, or well, 0 hours contracts essentially, that mean it's either the minimum or the living wage, whatever you want to call it. Now, when you leave that race course in the evening, every single one of them says, good night, are you coming back tomorrow? You know, and they're friendly, and they make you feel that your presence on the race course is welcome. I think that's something that Cheltenham could do an awful lot better with.
Dave, when we talk about some of the customer service areas that require improvement, there are one or two factors that I know sort of Cheltenham are quite keen to stress. I was talking about a general feeling of officiousness, I think would be the right word, that I hadn't witnessed before in terms of how many times your badge gets checked, why you need to queue before gates open, why every badge needs to be scanned with a QR code, and just much, much more rigorous policing of areas and a restriction of a freedom of movement that was always Cheltenham's biggest selling point over other racecourses. That lack of enclosure feeling, that ability to move the way that you wanted to move. And I thought, you know, gave everyone a sense that they were part of it, that it wasn't snotty, that everyone felt enfranchised. And I do wonder the extent to which the events of last year and Animal Rising have contributed to that, have contributed to a much more fastidious security policy, which then borders into officiousness. And it's getting your workforce to strike that balance between keeping people safe and being polite and courteous and letting them enjoy themselves.
I think it's difficult, but is it not possible to... I don't agree with the premise. I don't think this is your premise, but I don't agree with the premise that it's not possible to police and make an event safe whilst also making the attendees, I hate that word, but the people who are in attendance, making them feel happy and welcome. I think those are two very different things. There are lots of events that have really high level security, much higher level security than anything in racing, for example, that have to be policed, and yet the organisers of those events still manage to make their customers feel welcome. So yeah, of course, over the last couple of years, it seemed, although, you know, one can't take this for granted and be complacent, I get that, the feedback from Animal Rising was that they weren't going to target the Cheltenham Festival, but, you know, who knows, that could have been a bit of a bluff. But I think it's perfectly possible to police an event and make it safe, but also you can make people feel welcome. I mean, you know, what's the end game with someone saying you can't take teas and coffees up to a certain level because you might throw them at the horses? Well, in that case, we're all going to be stripped naked and we're not going to be able to take anything to the grandstands. I mean, you could throw anything at the horses rather than tea or coffee, couldn't you? You know, that's just absolutely ridiculous. One thing I would say about...
Should stress that this is all anecdotal. So, yeah, you just have to take somebody's word for
sure.
It.
Okay. It is anecdotal, and therefore it's in that sense, it's unscientific. But these are, you know, the stories that I've told you are genuine, and the my own experience of the employee in the car park, that's genuine. And the thing is, yes, these things are anecdotal, but they're anecdotal in very big numbers. Everybody, it seems, has got a story from the last week of someone who just basically gave a very good impression of not giving a stuff that they'd paid 120 quid to come on site and enjoy, you know, one of the greatest sporting events in the world. There's no such thing as a bad Cheltenham Festival. There's no such thing as a bad FIFA World Cup, but you get your USA 94s as well as you get your Italia 90s. Broadly, I would say that the 2024 Cheltenham Festival was more in line with America than it was in line with Italy. But I think that those things can be ironed out. That you could spend money if you're going to pay £7.50 for a pint of Guinness. By the way, I don't think you want to queue 20 minutes to pay that money. And so again, in terms of the way that those drinks are dispensed, maybe they should look at that. That would cost a few quid to pour those drinks more quickly and efficiently. But I think generally there are lots of things that Cheltenham can do, but they need to be much more aware in that customer facing area, because I agree with you. When I first started reporting at the Cheltenham Festival, I think it was. 97, I think, Make a Stand, McCoy winning was my first Cheltenham Festival working for the Press Association. And, you know, there was no dress code. Yes, people chose to walk around in tweed jackets and mustard cords, which they still do to this day. But it was a very relaxed place to be. It wasn't like going to some of the flat meetings in the summer where you had to wear a tie and someone say, you can't come in here without a jacket. It was a relaxed place. And that has gone, and it needs to come back.
There is still no dress code, so that's...
Yeah, no, of course. No, sorry, I didn't mean to say that they brought a dress code in. I was just merely trying to illustrate that back in the day, it was perceived as a place where you watched world-class sport, jump racing at its finest, but it had a relaxed ambiance in which to do it.
So, fine, yeah. I'm wary, however, of... conversations like this becoming a pile-on, where this institution becomes everyone's favourite whipping boy, even though there will be plenty of people who've had a good time. So let's try and be constructive then and say, how can this be better? What would we do if we were there? Lean into that a little bit more heavily for me.
Someone told me, I'm sorry to go on about this, someone told me that they'd gone up to a member of staff and said, can you tell me where a particular bar is? And they just said, sorry, I don't know. It's my first day. Drill those staff to say, right, if someone asks you where something is and you don't know, be aware of your nearest information points and say to that person, I'm sorry, I don't know myself, but I'll take you to the information point and we'll sort you out. All those things make people... feel that they're appreciated. I think they could spend a few grand on some benches around the place and screw those to the floor so that people who want to sit down on what is physically a fairly demanding day at the races, we all know, especially at the big meetings, that they've got somewhere to sit. So some of those issues, I think, can be sorted out with really minimal expense. Bring back the race makers. Blessed are the race makers. This was an idea that was sort of it was sneered at and laughed at a bit.
But it was borrowed, wasn't it, from the 2012 Olympics by Rod Street?
Absolutely.
And so then they started rolling it out across some participant British race courses, where liveried helpers were there to greet you with a big smile and say, "Yeah, the nearest gents is down there to the right," or the restaurant you're looking for is over there, or, you know, the pre-parade ring's over there. Do you want to go and have a look at the horses?
There would be dozens of people who want to be race makers. Probably, you know, certainly three figures who would apply to be race makers in exchange for, you know, same reason people are stewards at football and cricket matches. And, you know, I think they were unfairly derided, the race makers. As you say, they were at the Olympics. I only went to one day of the Olympics, which was a hockey match. But I do remember the people there. So, you know, we were on a site in East London. No one knew where to go. And obviously they were instructive
from somebody this week that is so serious that it makes me think that there's a major problem. It's more that you've had 1,000 small complaints. Like everybody's got something different that has just irritated them slightly. It hasn't maybe completely put them off going again. It hasn't completely ruined their day. They probably still come out saying they've had a, broadly speaking, a good time. But my email inbox after yesterday's Luck on Sunday was fuller than it's ever been. And just to take a random selection, here's one about the car parking from Jackie Telemac about the car parking. Diane Fotheringham, at the end of her email, says to me, we used to go when it was 3 days, public transport's not an option. We stopped going due to the drunken crowds. Now, that's a bone of contention, but I'll come to that in a minute. Alan Wayne, right now, I don't know if this is correct. I'd have to get this checked out. Says, think it's a disgrace that people with a blue badge have to pay for parking at the festival. I'd be staggered if that was correct, but I'm going to find out. Matthew Smith, can you ask Ian Renton why we were treated like hooligans and not allowed to take tea and coffee up to temporary stand in the best mate enclosure? Apparently the reason given was you might throw it at the horses. Ticket prices. Edward Dugdale, why was Cheltenham selling tickets at 55 for tats 2 weeks before the races when 51 weeks before the festival, he got priced at 56 quid instead of 75. That's going to cheese you off, isn't it? If you've gone in for the early bird price and then because they're struggling to shift tickets, you can actually get them cheaper 2 weeks before the event. It's rather like, well, you may as well wait and back the horse on the day. Anti-post betting's dead now. And on it goes. So you get a sort of flavour of lots and lots of different niggles, really.
Yeah, the pricing thing, those things are irritating. I read a letter, certainly it was on Twitter, and I think it was in the Racing Post as well, about somebody who had paid 120 quid to get in and then had to pay an additional 40 quid for a seat, which they claimed hadn't happened before. Again, I can't verify whether that's true or not. But the Jockey Club has to be on its guard against cheesing people off. First of all, yeah, we know crowds are down. We also know that 2022 was probably a bit of an outlier itself in terms of the record crowds because people have been locked up. Well, not everybody, but most of us have been locked up in our houses for most of the previous year. It's got to be very careful that it's not seen as, you know, sort of playing find the lady with its customers, that there are sort of hidden price increases. One thing they could do, this in the run up to the meeting, there was the story about the, was it the under fives who had to pay for a full ticket?
Yeah, there was a story. So yeah, but that had been the case for a long time.
And absolutely,
it was presented as though it was a new thing. But again, that's a public relations problem, there, isn't it?
Well, there's a public relations opportunity. I'm well aware that wasn't a new story, but I was going to say, well, next time for next year, you say under fives go free. We've changed that policy because we want the racegoers of the future to come in and enjoy what the Cheltenham Festival has to offer. Now, I'm before people say it's school time, numbnuts and all the rest of it, I'm well aware of that. But in cases where 5-year-olds might legally be able to attend the Cheltenham Festival, change that policy. Make it like so that you're seen to be doing something positive in a PR sense. The Jockey Club will do that, I'm sure, in the coming months, and they can have that one on me. But in terms of the actual cost of the event, the £7.50 pint of Guinness has always been Racing Post clickbait. You pay £7.50 for a pint of beer when you go to a premier attraction. If you go to the O2, it's very expensive. It is certainly £7.50. It's more than that. If you go to Wembley, the same. And they're pouring those out of cans as well when you go to Wembley if you want a pint of lager. So that's always been an easy story for the Racing Post. 120 quid for a ticket. Well, you pay that a ticket for England versus the West Indies, and the West Indies are no longer considered the test team than that they were in the days of, say, Fire of Babylon, for example. That's 120 quid. I purchased two tickets for Holland Park Opera later this summer. It's a charming place in West London to go, but you're unlikely to see world-class opera singers there, if I may say that. That's 102 quid for a second-tier seat. So if you go and see, you know, the pop stars of the day, he said, as if he knew what they were, who they were, you're going to be paying that sort of money. So I don't really have a big issue with the price of attending the Cheltenham Festival. I think it's broadly on a par with going to other events of the same caliber, but they've just got to be very careful with those, you know, the bump ups on the sly, and also they could do things like straight away say, right, from next year we've changed that policy, and if you want to bring an under five, they're more than happy to come in for nothing.
All right, so we've talked about customer service, how that might be improved. We've talked a little bit about whether the pricing points are correct. And as you said at the beginning of this conversation, you can't take the milk out of the tea. It's all the ingredients together. Now, my contention would be, though there is no evidence for this, that the decline in attendance was more down to what people had experienced and a number of factors than it was to do with what was happening on the racecourse. I may be wrong. Who knows? But clearly, there are deficiencies in some areas of the race programme. You only have to look at the National Hunt Chase, too many Grade 1 novice chases, handicaps not filling, and so forth. A sharp decline in number of runners over the 4 days. Now, Ian Renton conceded yesterday that there would be a hard look at whether a nip or tuck was needed at the festival, and every commentator this week has suggested, broadly speaking, some of the same things. David, would you be in favour of having a bit of a slice and dice?
Yeah, certainly. I think that the talk of converting some of these races to handicaps has gone on for quite a while now, hasn't it? Not just in the run up to this year's Cheltenham Festival, but that's certainly an idea. One thing that I did for our 24-page pullout on the Tuesday, which I'm not retrospectively advertising, you can't buy it now, is a piece.
Sorry, it was definitely 24 pages, was it not 22?
It was 24 plus 8, so yeah, it's 32 pages.
32 pages, okay, yeah.
Thank you. So that there was a piece on the 100 years of the Cheltenham Gold Cup, and of course, you know, in addition to the story of Red Splash winning the first race in 1924, I was asked to pick six signature horses in the 100 years of the race. And from memory, they were Golden Miller, Arkle, Desert Orchid, Best Mate, Quarto Star. And there was one other. And what was obvious was that when you're writing about Golden Miller and Arkle and Desi, you're writing about horses who have run in handicaps. That was part of their race program. And then, of course, latterly, you get the horses who just run in conditions races. These days in the racing media, we trumpet how many times the one of the first things I will write about a horse, so I'm as much part of the problem as the solution, is to say, oh, and this magnificent horse, this was his, I think it was in the case of State Man, his ninth Grade One victory of his career. Well, yeah, it was. How many, what price did he start for each of those Grade One wins? How many different horses did he beat when compiling those nine Grade One wins? You know, we've become obsessed with this idea of certainly horses remaining unbeaten, and also the number of Grade One victories they can amass. The Cheltenham Festival, as in many other areas of life, seems to row in with this belief that everyone must have prizes. And that isn't what top-level sport is about. It's about getting all of the people in one race, and all the horses in one race, and then a champion emerges. And so I row in with the view that some of these races have to become handicaps. And it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that the routes away from the elite championship races are too many at the moment. It's like a sort of A to Z going into central London. If you don't want to go to the champion hurdle, there are plenty of other places that you can go instead.
It struck me when people talk about the danger of Irish domination, and Julie Harrington, she'd got, I thought, quite an unusual statement at the end of the Cheltenham Festival. Not unwelcome, because it was a recognition that there was a lot of things to fix in British racing. But reflecting on the week as a whole, I felt that I was less bothered by who was training the winners and was quite happy to cheer Willie Mullins to the rafters for his extraordinary achievements. I was more bothered by the proliferation of odds-on shots and by coronations, processions, rather than races that were absorbing and thrilling. You know, for example, the Albert Bartlett featured a horse trained in the UK go well clear and got collared by a horse from a 350-plus horse stable in Ireland. It didn't bother me that it was won by a huge Irish behemoth stable, because it was a terrific and thrilling race and a really wonderful one to watch. I think what will put people off is just a succession of odds-on favourites and a succession of horses winning by double digits and it never looking unlikely at any point through the race.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, a horse who, it was a coronation. It wasn't a procession because he didn't win by a particular margin. But the champion hurdle victory of State Man, I mean, it was sort of like it was just greeted with polite applause. You know, we talk about the Cheltenham Festival roar when the tapes go up for the Supreme Novices. People often talk about the pilgrims who venture to the Cotswolds for those 4 days. And, you know, we're used to seeing things pretty raucous. Some Herbert in the crowd will say three cheers for such and such, and everyone else will row in with it. But when Ballyburn, who, you know, in many people's eyes was the horse of the future and possibly the performance of the week, maybe that's stretching it a bit. But again, it was a polite ripple of applause. It was like an audience when the conductor comes on stage at the start of a concert. Or it wasn't sort of like, wow, this is amazing. It was just like, well, yes, we have to acknowledge this, so this is how we're going to do it. Really underwhelming. The first 2 days in particular, as has been noted by other people, were very, very flat. And to the purist, Champion Hurdle Day is the favourite day of the four. In many ways, it's certainly been my favourite day. Thursday was lifted by the presence of two football managers, one of whom is 77, Harry Redknapp, and one of whom is 82, Sir Alex Ferguson. And so the journalists got something meaty to write about, but with the greatest respect, I don't wish to sound overly gloomy, but those people aren't going to be around forever. Friday, I suppose Galopin Deschamps was the horse who rescued the Gold Cup day by, I thought, a no-nonsense victory in the Blue Ribbon. But yeah, I mean, certainly the first 2 days of the meeting were incredibly flat, I thought, from an atmospheric point of view.
Interestingly, some of the overhead shots of that very famous winner's enclosure, of course, the new construction, which I thought was brilliantly done, allowed more people to stand at an even higher vantage point and cheer winners in. And there were quite a few races where you could see massive gaps on the steppings, suggesting that, and I don't think this is suggestive of crowd reduction necessarily, because there's still enough people there that you could fill that space easily, but that rush to greet a winner that there was before, where people would almost be running away from their spot in the grandstand to come and greet the winner in. I think that sense had gone a little bit. You know, if you're standing there watching Ballyburn, you know, roar up the hill lengths clear in a manner that had been suggested to you every day for the last 6 weeks, are you going to go, I've got to run to the winner's enclosure to give this a big roar?
So fewer people, the pilgrims, the cognoscenti, if you like, were packing the stand, the steps to welcome those champions in. That was certainly true from my perspective. And you know, my job is to go down after every one of those championship races and talk to connections. And you have that amphitheatre where it can be packed. You know, we take the clock back to the days of sort of Denman winning the Gold Cup, Corto Star, etc. So there were a few of those. Why was that? Was it because 7 of the 27 races had an odds on favourite, the racing was less competitive? Was it because they felt that someone in the car park had been rude to them? Was it because of external factors? You know, that it's Cheltenham obviously could do with liaising with the local hoteliers to say, why the hell are you pricing this event out of the market by charging 700 quid for a hotel room? Those are all things to consider. Just with regard to it's been on the front page of the Racing Post today, Ben Pauling saying it's not an Irish domination, it's a Willie Mullins domination. That's a view that's been echoed over the last 48, 72 hours. I'm not sure that's true. I'm looking at, as we speak, at a tweet from Kevin Blake, who obviously is consistently excellent in this area. He said, if Willie Mullins hadn't had a single runner this week, the Prestbury Cup would have still finished 15-12 to Ireland, with the Grade 1 races finishing 10-4. So I think that rebuts the idea that this is Willie Mullins and not Ireland. So I don't agree with that view, but neither do I agree with this idea that it's just British racing that's in trouble.
Indeed. I mean, Kim Bailey made the point, didn't he, on my show yesterday, that his prize money haul, which gets him 25th in the British trainers table, would get him into 5th in the Irish trainers table. I mean, the top four between them, Mullins, Elliott, De Bromhead and Cromwell, hoover up the whole lot. I mean, then it is an absolutely precipitous cliff, which you find after that.
Yeah, in Ireland, it's even more of a man bites dog story when one of those smaller stables wins a big race. Flat and jumps, isn't it? So whilst we've got problems in Britain, which have been acknowledged by Julie Harrington over the weekend, I sort of agree with you. I think the BHA can't really win in a situation like that. If they sit on their hands for a week and then put out a statement, people in the interim are saying, well, what are the BHA doing about all this? And then when they do it on the Saturday morning, they're accused of a knee-jerk reaction. So broadly, I don't think anyone could really disagree with what Julie Harrington said. A couple of people, I think, had taken a different view about the men and women in Britain being more than a match for their Irish counterparts. But she said urgent action is needed and not just little pruning. And I think we all agree with that.
I noted that Ian Renton yesterday said that he agreed with some of what Julie Harrington said, which suggests to me that there might be a little bit of a difference of opinion. I'm not going to go as far as to call it a battleground over how the race programme might be tweaked. I would think that might be quite a robust discussion in time.
Yes, it will be. Bit of Julie Harrington's quote is about how every different interest group in racing has to make a sacrifice for everybody's good. To achieve this, the sport must work together with urgency and clarity of purpose. The times of being reluctant to embrace change or new ideas, lack of transparency, BHA, and focusing on narrow self-interest must be put firmly behind us, she said. Sorry about that. So again, that's a bit of a shot across the bows to the different constituents, isn't it? Say, look, some of you are going to have to take a hit with this, and we know that, you know, for those of us who think the racecourses have got too much power in the first place, they're gonna have to take a hit in order for the long term good of the sport, aren't they? So I think it's inevitable. I think it was broadly a good thing to do on Saturday. I agree with what Julie Harrington said, but there are plenty of interest groups, notably the racecourses, who are going to read that and think, all right, well, you know, don't think it's going to be easy to get us to take a hit, because we've got our bottom line, which we're going to guard jealously, and we're going to be reluctant to do that.
Well, Well, the other big news over the weekend concerned multiple classic winning jockey Shamey Heffernan, one of three jockeys only currently riding to have won the Derby and the Oaks at Epsom, multiple Irish Derbies as well, and a man who has been part of the furniture at Aidan O'Brien's Ballydoyle stable for the business of three decades. He has decided to move on by mutual consent. So where next in the autumn of his career for this highly talented horseman and a fine judge as well? Well, Paddy Toomey is a man who's not letting the grass grow under his feet, and it seems as though he is keen to use Shamey's services. Paddy joins me now. Paddy, just tell me where you're at with Shamey and what role he's likely to play for you.
Yeah, look, in the last couple of weeks, Shamey has, you know, obviously decided to finish his association with, you know, Ballydoyle, and he started coming in here a couple of times a week riding work, and, you know, it's great to have him. He brings a lot of experience to someone like me who's starting out, and, you know, he brings experience on a daily, you know, workday basis. It's great to have him on the team.
And I'm guessing you're probably finding out exactly what Aidan O'Brien knew for decades, really, and what all the Coolmore guys knew for decades, that you can't beat a judge like that with that much experience under his belt.
No, look, it's great to have. Shamey has tremendous experience, and, you know, he's a lovely rider, and he's ridden for me twice in the past, and both times he won, and he brings that sort of level, you know, on the mornings here. It's a great asset. You know, Billy Lee and himself get on well, and they enjoy riding work together, and look, hopefully it's something that it will grow as the season goes on.
I mean, I know every trainer obviously has a degree of horsemanship and a very good eye, but how much is that sort of feedback from a rider like that valuable? How much would it make you change the way you think?
Well, for someone like myself, you know, who's hopefully just starting and, you know, and out and hoping to progress their career, someone like Shamey, who's been at the very top level for a long time and, you know, ridden top horses, you know, Derbies, etc., Breeders' Cup, and travelled the world and spent, you know, three decades in, you know, with Aidan O'Brien and seeing all how that goes on, he brings a huge, you know, he brings a huge amount of knowledge and experience to me, and, you know, it's hopefully we can, you know, get on well and make use of it together.
It must be a bit of an unexpected Christmas present, to be honest, because they don't grow on trees, guys like him, do they?
No, you know, I was, you know, obviously surprised at the time, but it's great. He's living very local to me. He's within 5 miles of me, so it suits both of us. And obviously, you know, Billy and himself are used to riding together in races, and, you know, friendly and similar weights and that. So, you know, from a training point of view, it makes the work morning very easy, and, you know, to have that much experience and to have, you know, someone like Shamey who has that experience, it definitely is a huge help for here, and, you know, hopefully it'll be a help going forward.
Grass not growing under our feet, really. No sooner is Cheltenham done than we're here. The Curragh, first day of the turf flat season in Ireland with Irish Lincolnshire Day, and I know it's a bank holiday with you as well, because St Patrick's Day fell on a Sunday. You've got a runner today in a maiden. What can you tell me about? And do you know what? I confess I know nothing about your runner today, so you can tell me all about them.
Yeah, it's our first runner of the year. Nice 3-year-old colt by Sayuni that we bought from Norman Williamson at the Breeze Ups last year. Mark Max Day Avenue Bloodstock bought him. He's a lovely colt. He's ready to run. It looks a good race as usual. Curragh Maiden, start of the season. But he's a nice colt who's been training well, and I'm looking forward to running him today.
Great stuff. Paddy, best of luck for the season.
Thanks very much, Nick. Appreciate it.
Well, really pleased to have launched our series on Overbury people with Overbury Stud and Simon Sweeting. You'll have heard him the week before last explaining how many different people intersect with the stud and with the stallions and with the business. And we're launching it in earnest today by checking in with jockey Alice Stevens. Now, you'll know Alice well because she's having the best season of her career. She's had 18 winners to date with the promise of plenty more to come. She's ridden winners the last 2 days. But her association with Overbury goes back quite some time and reached a glorious fruition yesterday when she rode an Overbury side winner to victory on debut at Huntingdon at very big odds. First of all, Alice, just tell me a little bit about you and the stud and where your association started.
So my mum is very good friends with Simon's wife, and they've been childhood friends, and I needed a sponsor just to help me get through Pointy a little bit, and mum spoke to Simon and he kindly offered to sponsor me, and it went from there, really.
Which is great that he was supporting you when you were riding pointing. When you were starting out and riding in pointer points, was it always the ambition that you would transition to being a fully fledged pro? And was this the plan?
Not at all, really. I always loved my pointing, and I was riding for good people pointing, and it was quite hard to let go of. But when the door opens and I've got offered opportunities with Henry and Harry and, you know, lots of other great trainers, I couldn't say no. So yeah, we went for it, and seems to be going well so far.
So that's Henry Daly and Harry Derham, at either end of the experience spectrum, but clearly both very, very good trainers and both in very good form as well. Who was it who really gave you the nudge? You said, come on, you're good enough to do this.
I don't know really, as in it was Henry always maybe had it in his mind without ever telling me, but it was worth a punt, because, you know, opportunities to ride for an up and coming trainer like Harry doesn't really come along very often. And, you know, I was riding nice horses for Ben Brookhouse as well, who's obviously, you know, going places, and I just needed a someone solid behind me like Henry, which probably helped push me over the edge of doing it, because I just knew Henry would always have my back, and it was just worth a punt from there.
Yeah, because he's a, you know, solid, sensible guy with a lot of experience. He's not going to say to you, yeah, you can do this, unless he thinks you can.
Yeah, exactly. And he's seen me through, you know, riding. He gave me my first ever winner on the track, and it was just that we've always been very closely connected from there on, and sorry, there's a lot of noise. he's just a really loyal person and a great guy to ride for and to have behind me.
I do always wonder, actually. I mean, I chat to a lot of jockeys at various stages of their career on this podcast, the importance of having a good mentor. And it's not just about having a good boss or, you know, having a good job, but someone who you can always rely on for advice. Do you think we're getting better at that as a sport, of making sure that people are well looked after?
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. You know, and it's all about patience, I think, and riding for the right people. Like, I know Henry's never going to put me in a position with owners and horses until I'm ready. So, you know, he's really minded me, and you just got to trust the process. And as long as you work hard, you know, you will be rewarded. And when you're doing it for good people that have your best interests at heart as well as theirs, it's a real positive.
I know you sort of said you almost kind of done this by accident, or got this far by accident. Do you feel different now as a rider, as a jockey, as a sports person to how you did a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, I'm riding a lot more than, you know, because pointing, you know, you've obviously got your weekends is your days, and then you might pick up the odd one or two in amateur races over the week. So I'm getting more experience riding more, riding against, you know, professionals, and I'm learning a hell of a lot every time I ride. And I think, yeah, it's just the process, isn't it, of gaining confidence in yourself and your ability, and, you know, going out there and trusting yourself. You know, it's, you can't do anything without confidence, can you?
And you've clearly got plenty at the moment, winners the last couple of days. Now, this is a nice bit of symmetry, because Madame Le Papillon is by one of the Overbury Stallions, Frontiersman, who's a bit of a secret weapon from very few runners. He's having a lot of success at the moment. What sort of feeling did she give you yesterday?
Well, if I'm honest with you, Simon came to me. We did it once before with a horse called Lupus Regem that Ollie Murphy ran and bought and won a novice hurdle with. And he came to me a couple of years ago when she was a 2-year-old, just a fine, bonny little filly, not overly big, just looked likeable, nothing outstanding. And, you know, the whole way through, she's just been very unassuming, to be honest with you. I've done most of her myself, which was very satisfactory yesterday. And, you know, Laura was very good to take her on for the last 5 weeks, 6 weeks to finish her up. But, I couldn't believe how she did it, really. She was exceptionally raw. She didn't really face to any of the kickback or any of the horses around her. And then eventually when she dropped her head, going into the back straight and faced up to it all, I could get a breather into her, and she just was all very cosy, very, very cosy. And when, by the time she hit the front, I was pretty idle and having a look around. So there's plenty more to come. I just wasn't really expecting it to be quite that easy.
And have you had any experience of any more by this stallion, or is she the first one?
She's the first one I've had, like, proper on hand, you know, going through the process. I've broken maybe one or two in last year at Fran and Charlie Post, but nothing quite of the same sort of line as her, you know, been from start to finish. He's a fairly unexposed stallion, isn't he?
It must have been incredibly satisfying for you yesterday.
Yeah, I think the cameras caught me having a bit of a celebration, but you know, it's what you get up every day to do, and it was the relief and satisfaction of we did it.
Now, what I didn't know was that you'd once had the extraordinary privilege of being able to use Cave Tara, but on quite an unusual mare. Just tell me about that.
Yeah, Sunday's Best. I bought her. Me and Mum just decided to buy another horse, cheap little horse that we knew nothing about. Pony racing, sorry. This is, and she's exceptionally well bred, and I won at Cheltenham Pony Race on her. And we decided, we didn't know how well bred she was. We were very ignorant about it, and Simon suggested putting her to Cave Tar, and we got a foal out of her, and I mean, he's done nothing, but we've got a little frontiersman at home, which is quite exciting. Mm. 3-year-old, so hopefully, you know, the sire keeps progressing and producing winners, and he might be worth a little bit of something down the line.
Well, Alice, great to talk to you today. Long may the winners keep flowing. You've actually got a ride today that's got a bit of a chance, Gugus Collange. It could be 3 winners in 3 days.
Yeah, we'll see. I did that a couple of weeks ago and then it went a bit dry, but we'll try and get the third one.
Best of luck. Thanks for chatting to us.
Thanks so much, Nick.
All right, just some news about Frankie Dettori. He rode a horse called Matanzas Creek at Santa Anita on Saturday night, and the horse won quite comfortably. Now, sadly, a couple of strides after the post, the horse suffered an injury that subsequently proved to be fatal, and Frankie was pile-driven into the dirt at Santa Anita. He got up and walked away, took himself off his remaining 3 mounts. He rode again yesterday evening, so that is good news that he's back. He also, it has been confirmed by the Dubai Racing Club, will ride Newgate, the horse aboard whom he won the Santa Anita Handicap for Bob Baffert in the World Cup itself. And he's going to ride Lord North in the Group 1 Dubai Turf. I don't think anyone's surprised. That horse is seeking an extraordinary 4th consecutive victory in a Group or Grade 1 race for John and Thady Gosden. And I believe he's going to be riding the horse who won the Coronation Cup so well, Emily Upjohn, in the Shima Classic. So a good book of rides for him there, and a nasty incident on Saturday from which there was a narrow escape. David Yates, have you got a selection for me for today?
I have, Nick. We're going to go to Fontwell Park and the 2:45 race, and I'm going to tip a horse who is 14 years old, Max Dynamo. This horse is the outsider of the 5-strong party, but has a first and a second from 2 visits to Fontwell. The latter of those was a second in the Southern National last November. So I don't think that Emma Jane Bishop's veteran is ready for pipe and slippers just yet. Hopefully he can get another victory in West Sussex this afternoon. It's the 2:45 race at Fontwell Park, and the selection is number 2, Max Dynamo.
David, thank you very much for your company today. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that debrief of the Cheltenham Festival. That was Monday, the 18th of March. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.